From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, two Southern women who've spent their lives in the world of politics. We meet former First Lady Rosalynn Carter. Her new book is about taking care of sick loved ones at home. She'll tell us about the choices she's made looking after her 89-year-old mother. Also, Lindy Boggs talks with us about her experiences as a congressman's wife, then as a member of Congress. She won her husband Hale Boggs' seat after he disappeared in a plane crash in 1972. She remained in Congress through 1990. Boggs is the mother of journalist Cokie Roberts. And Lloyd Schwartz reads a new poem about his mother in a nursing home. It's called She Forgets. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A federal grand jury has charged the man accused of firing at the White House with trying to kill President Clinton. Francisco Duran has been charged with 10 other counts, including assault on federal officers and use of a gun during a crime. He's expected to be arraigned in the next few days. Consumers may soon pay more for fruits and vegetables because of the crop damage in Florida left by Tropical Storm Gordon, which has now become a hurricane. Valerie Alker of member station WSFP reports.
More than 35,000 acres of winter vegetables and fruit in Dade County alone were damaged or destroyed by Tropical Storm Gordon. Ray Gilmer of the Florida Fruit and Vegetable Association says it's likely the destruction will drive up prices at the grocery store.
Florida is the salad bowl for the United States. Florida produces roughly 90% of the fruits and vegetables used by American consumers during those winter months. And so a storm like this certainly will have an impact.
Gilmer says tomatoes, squash, beans, cabbage, and potatoes all took a beating. But he says the extent of the damage won't be known for several more days. For National Public Radio, I'm Valerie Alker in Fort Myers.
Irish Prime Minister Albert Reynolds announced his resignation in Parliament today after losing the support from his coalition partners.
I have taken this decision for the good of the country, in the interests of stability, and in particular, to ensure the continuation of the peace process.
Reynolds had faced a no-confidence vote over his choice of a judge. The judicial nominee had taken 7 months to act on a Northern Ireland request to extradite a priest that was accused of child molestation. The judge has also resigned his job. There's a new development in the efforts to settle the matter of the failed Bank of Credit and Commerce International, or BCCI. Liquidators say a deal's been reached between creditors and the major shareholder, the government of Abu Dhabi. The BBC's James Morgan reports.
An important milestone has been passed in resolving the conflicting claims arising out of the biggest fraud in history. The Bank of Credit and Commerce International was closed down in 1991 when it owed $10,000 million without assets to cover the debt. A year ago, a Luxembourg court threw out a $1.7 thousand settlement proposal, which was to give the main shareholder, the government of Abu Dhabi, more compensation than other creditors. Abu Dhabi also had to pay money into the pool of assets. There are about 500,000 creditors, and they consist mostly of those who deposited their money with the bank. The main difference in the proposal today is that the sum put up by the government of Abu Dhabi is fixed rather than variable according to circumstances. But this still does not reveal how much creditors will receive, because not all the remaining assets of BCCI have been recovered.
James Morgan reporting. On Wall Street, the Dow is down more than 18 points. This is NPR. President Clinton is talking about the results of Election Day. He told a group of people gathered to meet him in Hawaii today that voters are frustrated with government. Mr. Clinton says the American people don't want more gridlock. Instead, they're calling on the president and the incoming Republican-controlled Congress to put the United States on the right track. Mr. Clinton has vowed to meet with the GOP leadership early next week. He says he wants to capitalize on bipartisan support for the World Trade Agreement, or GATT as it's known. It's to be voted on by the lame duck Congress right after Thanksgiving. A new report says parents need to help children learn to write better. The study, sponsored by education groups, says parents can do that best by example. NPR's Barbara Campbell reports.
The report says parents don't realize how important writing is to a child's future. In a list of priorities, parents put writing far behind reading, math, and computer skills. American Federation of Teachers President Tom Mooney says educators must help parents understand that writing to communicate and to persuade is essential in higher education and on the job.
If they think that it's a video world, if they think that technology somehow replaces the need to learn good writing skills, that they're fooling themselves.
The sponsors of the study say parents should encourage children to write more, including writing letters rather than making phone calls. And parents should set an example at home with personal and job-related writing. I'm Barbara Campbell in Washington.
The nation's Catholic bishops have given the medical establishment some ethical guidance. The National Conference of Catholic Bishops has voted on directives that let doctors ease the pain of terminally ill patients, even if it speeds death. The directive also outlaws mercy killing in 1,200 Catholic healthcare facilities. The bishops have already unanimously approved a statement yesterday condemning violence. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jimmy Carter has expanded and redefined the role of an ex-president. We're about to find out what former First Lady Rosalynn Carter has been up to. She's personally and professionally involved in the issues surrounding caregiving, taking care of a sick loved one. Rosalynn Carter is the honorary chairperson of the Rosalynn Carter Institute for Human Development, whose mission is to understand the caregiving process. And she's the co-author of a new book for caregivers called Helping Yourself Help Others. Caregiving can radically change your life and alter the patterns of family life. Carter writes that caregiving has been part of her life since she was a girl. In 1940, her father was diagnosed with leukemia. He didn't want to stay in a hospital, so her mother took care of him at home.
My mother was 34 years old when my father got sick. I was the oldest child. I was 14. My little sister was 4 with two brothers in between. And my father got sick, and he was sick maybe for about 6 months. And we were devastated. The whole family was. That's one thing that we learn in studying caregiving is that it affects the family relationships. But we were devastated. And my mother's an only child. The next year, 11 months later, her mother died. And my grandfather came to live with us. He was the father figure in our family then for years. He lived to be 95 years old. So in the beginning, he was a lot of help. Still, mother was tied down to take care of him for years and years and years.
What was it like for you to have a sick father at home? Were you responsible for any of his care?
Well, of course I tried to help mother. I was the oldest. I was a daughter, and I found out that most caregivers are women. But mother depended on me to help her. And I knew that he was not going to live. And, of course, you just feel helpless. I used to read to him, comb his hair, or do anything I could to try to make him happy. And also I had this terrible guilt feelings because I was only 13 years old. And as a child I had sometimes bad feelings about him. If he called me down or punished me, or wouldn't let me go across the street to see my friend. This was when I was a little girl, little child. And I felt really guilty, thinking maybe if I had been better, he would have lived. I didn't realize until I was writing my autobiography and working through these things that's normal for children who lose a parent by death or divorce. They feel guilty, like maybe they had something to do with it. One of the things that I hope this book will do is let caregivers know that it's all right to feel, that it's perfectly normal to feel guilty, because all caregivers do. Even if they're with someone they're taking care of 24 hours a day, they feel they might do it better, or they feel guilty because they get angry with the loved one they're taking care of. All these emotions are normal. And I think it's very helpful to know that. It helped me to know that it was all right for me to feel guilty.
Did your mother ever confide in you feelings about resentment or guilt during your father's illness or during the 25 years when she cared for your grandfather?
No, she never, ever complained, never. And, of course, she was devastated, and I knew that because she cried a lot. But when my father was, when we found out he was sick, and then, of course, when he were taking care of him and so forth. When I was writing the book, I asked her one day if she ever suffered from burnout, just being completely overwhelmed and exhausted, or if she didn't ever get angry. She said, no, Papa was good. He was just really good to take care of. And then she tucked her head a little bit and said, well, he did keep me awake all night in the middle of the night toward the end of his life. And she started talking about some things that had not been easy. But I never ever heard her complain about it before. And this was not complaining. This was kind of reflective.
You grew up watching your mother care for people, first your father and then your grandfather. And I wonder how that affected your feelings about the responsibility you did or didn't want to have to care for others when you grew up.
Well, it was a terrible time of my life. I was in the eighth grade, I suppose, the seventh grade maybe, when my father died, in the eighth grade the next year, and it was like nothing good ever happened. The World War II started right in the middle of that. I look back on it as a really, really difficult time in my life. But also, I can identify with people who have to take care of somebody all the time. And I even consider myself a caregiver now, because my mother is almost 89 years old. She'll be 89 on Christmas Eve. She lives alone. She drives her car, which we worry about. I know she wants me at home, and I can't be there all the time. And I feel guilty about that, although I have a brother at home who can take good care of her if she needs him. But I'm the daughter. I'm the oldest. She depended on me when my father was sick, and then to help with my grandfather, and she just likes for me to be there. So I can sympathize and understand the feelings of those who are responsible for someone else, for caring for someone else. And caregivers are affected financially, physically, emotionally when they have to take care of someone all the time, and so often are just they're really invisible. They feel left out because attention is almost always on the one who is ill or the one who needs care.
Could you talk a little bit about how in your own life you've decided to divide your time between the time that you give your mother to watch out for her and care for her and the time that you've, decided to spend to your work and to other aspects of your family life?
Well, we have so many things going on at the Carter Center. I'm so involved in so many programs, and my mother understands that. She likes for me to be at home, and she knows that I can't be there all the time. And as I said, I feel very guilty about it. But when I am at home, she eats lunch with me almost every day. Spends the night with me if she doesn't feel good. She's had some health problems, and sometimes she's nervous about staying alone at night. And she doesn't want me to worry about her. I do, but she doesn't want me to. But also, I have a brother at home who has fixed a room on his house so that Mother can come and be with him if she's not feeling good. She can come spend the night with him. She likes to be in her own house. It's important to me to be there with her on holidays. I'm at home maybe a third of the time. I think Jimmy says we spend about a third of our time at the Carter Center, and we travel. We have so many programs, particularly in the developing world and our conflict resolution programs and so forth, that we have to be gone a lot.
Well, a third of the time to be home and near a parent is actually comparatively a lot of time when you think of the number of people who are living very far away.
That's right.
From their parents and maybe spend a few days a year together.
And when I'm not at home, I call her. And the time I worry about is when we are overseas. We go to Africa a lot, visiting. We have health and agriculture programs there and conflict resolution programs in other places. And I can't always get her when I try. And that's when I worry about her most.
You've written that your grandfather died in 1966 during your husband's first gubernatorial campaign. Was it hard to take time off from the campaign to be with the family when when your grandfather died, I think how hard it must be for people in public office who probably feel that they can't afford to take a minute away from campaigning when there's a personal tragedy to deal with.
I remember it as though it were today, because I was sitting in a restaurant with some people who were prospective supporters, and somebody came in and told me that Papa had died. And I just quit and went home. I had to. I just canceled my schedule because my mother, of course, needed me. And so I went home. But I don't remember now how long I stayed at home, probably just a week or so before I was back out on the campaign trail.
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy lost the election that year. He ran for governor and lost. And so it was not long. And it was a brief campaign because our leading candidate had a heart attack and dropped out. And Lester Maddox mm-hmm. was running for governor. That left Lester Maddox in the race. And so Jimmy tried to find somebody else to run. He was a state senator at the time. And nobody else would run, so he decided to run for governor and didn't have about an eight-week campaign. It was about 8 weeks before the election, and we didn't win. But so I was not gone for very long and was at home then to be with Mother.
Rosalind Carter is my guest. Her new book is called Helping Yourself Help Others, a book for caregivers. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Rosalind Carter. She's written a new book for caregivers called Helping Yourself Help Others. I know it was a very difficult transition for you and your husband to make after Jimmy Carter lost his reelection bid. And I wonder what it's been like for you now to see him getting hailed as one of the most important former presidents in recent history, hailed for the way he's redefine the role of ex-president?
Well, of course, I think he was one of our greatest presidents, too. But most of the things that we do don't get a lot of publicity purposely. For instance, we work on conflict resolution and human rights, and we have 26 health programs operating out of the Carter Center, mostly in Africa, with poor in the developing countries. We have agriculture programs teaching small farmers and mostly in Africa to increase their food production. And those, if we go into those countries and the head of state gets credit for what's going on, then he really is gung-ho about the program. So we don't put our name on things like that. And with human rights efforts, if Jimmy writes a head of state, if one of the major human rights organizations comes to us and say we have a really tough problem with a head of state, then Jimmy can write him a letter or call him and say, I've heard this is going on in your country. I know it's not true. I hope you will look into it. And almost invariably, that leader will either let whoever he has in prison out or try do something to overcome that situation.
Were you worried about him when he was in Haiti negotiating, even after the warplanes had taken off, the U.S. warplanes?
Well, we've been to Haiti. We were in Haiti 7 times with the election. We know all of those people. And Cedrus was in charge of security during the election when we were there, so we had known him well. And President Jonathan, we had known. He was on the Supreme Court, an older man, 81 years old. We had known all of these people, and we had come back from a trip to Africa, and Jim had a letter saying that Cedrus wanted to talk to him. Well, Cedrus and Aristide both had been trying to get Jimmy to negotiate for a good while. And anyway, for 3 or 4 days then, before he went to Haiti, He'd been on the telephone with him. And I get in all the meetings when we're negotiating because I take notes. I have a good excuse to get in the meetings. And I was on the other telephone taking notes with Etcetera's phone calls. But then it was not appropriate for me to go with Sam Nunn and Colin Powell going with Jimmy. But he told me that if he did get the agreement, that he was going to stay because he wanted to be sure it was carried out. And so when he called me that night to tell me, he called me from the president's palace to tell me that they had just gotten the agreement, and he said that he was coming on and spend the night in Washington. And I said, I thought you said you're going to stay. And he said, well, Bill Clinton said he had enough to worry about without worrying about my security. And so I can tell you that I was thankful when I saw him get on that, when I saw that airplane take off.
Well, what do you think of the criticisms that have been leveled against your husband for negotiating with dictators like Raoul Cedras and cutting good deals for them, you know, because he's living well in South America now, and the United States government is helping him financially to live well?
Well, it doesn't really bother me because the people that make those statements are just uninformed. Those agreements had already been made an agreement that was signed with the United Nations help for granting them amnesty and so forth. All Jimmy did was just, they had signed the papers, they had never lived up to the agreement. And Jimmy's role was to get them to live up to the agreement, so he had nothing to do with offering them amnesty. And also, I think not only in that, but in North Korea and others, I think a lot of people that criticize just don't understand what conflict resolution is. You cannot go and say, you are bad and here's the good person, and if you don't agree to this, well, you can't do that and get any kind of agreement. And the conflict resolution is a science. I think just a lot of people just don't understand that.
Hillary Clinton has been criticized by many people for being too much the activist first lady, for getting too involved with policy. You were criticized yourself by some people for getting too involved with the president's decisions. And I wonder what you make of the criticisms of Hillary.
Well, I think, and her approval rating really went up after they first came into office. And I think a lot of the criticism now is just politics. Anybody trying to get it, Democrats are trying to get it, her husband will criticize the first lady. I hope after this election that will go away a little bit. But I think the role of first lady is changing as the role of women is changing. And hopefully it's easier. I think it's easier for Hillary than it was for me. You'll have to remember we were in the White House a long time ago. Amy Carter was 9 years old when we went to Washington. She's now 27. And I went to cabinet meetings. I went to Latin America. I was briefed regularly by the people from Latin America program. I was briefed on problems with the elderly by the counselor to on aging to the president. And attended the cabinet meetings. I got a lot of criticism for that, but I had campaigned all over the country on issues, telling people what Jimmy was going to do. And then when I went out in the country, which I did often, I wanted to be able to tell him what he was doing and to know why he was doing it. So I got a lot of criticism, but what you learn in politics is that it doesn't matter what you do, you're going to be criticized, so you may as well be criticized for doing the things you want to do.
I have one last question for you. Your new book is for caregivers. And, you know, mental illness is an issue that you've been devoting your time to for many years now. I wonder what your thoughts are on learning that former President Reagan, your former opponent, has Alzheimer's now.
Well, I think it's a tragedy for anybody who has Alzheimer's. My heart just goes out to the Reagan family. I have come in contact with a lot of people in this since I became interested in caregiving who suffer from Alzheimer's, and a lot of people, caregivers, husbands or wives of those who are affected. It is a very, very difficult situation to be in, and just a tragedy for any family. So, as I said, I just do sympathize with them in this situation.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
I enjoyed it.
Rosalind Carter is the author of a new book for people who are caring for sick loved ones. It's called Helping Yourself Help Others. It's agonizing to watch someone you love mentally and physically deteriorate. We have a new poem we want to share with you, written by Lloyd Schwartz, who you probably know as Fresh Air's classical music critic. The poem is called She Forgets.
She Forgets. The one who told me about the Holocaust, who taught me moral distinctions, who gave me music and told me jokes, is in a nursing home. Lonely, scared, surrounded only by people so much worse off, inarticulate, incapacitated, drooling, she thinks she's in a crazy house. She's not crazy. She's there. I put her there because she can't take care of herself, can't be left alone. She's old. She forgets. She forgets her medicine. She forgets what she's not supposed to eat. She forgets what day it is. She remembers who she is and who she was, and knows she's not herself. She can't remember what's wrong with her. What's wrong with me, honey? Or why she's there. But she knows her brain isn't working right. Her brain needs air. Oxygen has a hard time squeezing through her hardened arteries. So her blood congeals. Little clots cause little strokes, which destroy her memory. Aspirin, which thins the blood and helps keep the oxygen flowing, might help her remember. But she's old. Part of her stomach has turned upside down. Her food gets stuck in her chest, blocks her breath. She panics, forces herself to vomit, which makes her bleed, which damages her heart. A simple operation could fix her stomach, but doctors won't operate on someone with a damaged heart. And aspirin makes her bleed, so she can't take aspirin. So she forgets. I live in another city. Once after I came to visit, she wasn't thinking about her food. She ate too much or too fast, and the food wouldn't go down. So she panicked, forced herself to vomit, and had a heart attack. She was in the hospital for 3 weeks, which she doesn't remember. So I've had to put the one who gave me music and told me jokes, who taught me moral distinctions and warned me never to forget the Holocaust. I've had to put her in a nursing home, a crazy house, where she's scared and lonely, where she stares out the window and asks, "What day is today? Why can't I go home? What's wrong with me, honey? Why am I here?"
Lloyd Schwartz is Fresh Air's classical music critic. He won the 1994 Pulitzer Prize for Criticism. His book of poems is called Goodnight, Gracie. His new poem, She Forgets, has not yet been published. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Lindy Boggs came to Washington in 1941 when her husband, Hale Boggs, was elected to Congress. In 1972, his plane disappeared in Alaska, never to be found. Lindy Boggs ran for her late husband's seat and won. She remained in Congress through 1990. Coming up, we talk about her 50 years in political life. She's written a new memoir called Washington Through a Purple Veil. As you may know, Lindy Boggs is the mother of journalist Cokie Roberts. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The man who allegedly fired at the White House last month with a semi-automatic weapon has now been charged by a federal grand jury with trying to kill President Clinton. U.S. Attorney Eric Holder says Francisco Duran still faces several other charges stemming from the incident.
The grand jury also indicted Mr. Duran on 10 other counts, including 4 counts of assaulting a federal officer and a single count each of possession of a firearm by a convicted felon, destruction of United States property, use of a firearm during the commission of a crime of violence, and interstate transportation of a firearm.
Duran already has a 1991 conviction for assault during his service in the Army. Conviction on the charge of attempted assassination of the president has a maximum penalty of life in prison. The Haitian death toll from Tropical Storm Gordon is now over 500. The Haitian government says the real death toll may never be known because many bodies have been buried in the mud. Gordon has now increased to a hurricane. Bob Sheets directs the National Hurricane Center. He says Gordon is moving off the U.S. coast.
Our forecast turns out to be correct. It will not threaten either the U.S. mainland or Bermuda. It stays sort of midway between there and the Outer Banks of North Carolina and continue to move out to sea on the toward the northeast. We do not expect the core of the hurricane to affect either location. They might get some fringe effects, wave action, things like that.
Forecaster Bob Sheets. Pentagon officials are being more clear on the state of American military readiness. New information shows there are weak spots in the military across the entire force. The officials say among the divisions getting the next to lowest grade are tank divisions at Fort Riley, Kansas, Fort Carson, Colorado, and Fort Hood, Texas. Panama's National Assembly will investigate accusations of money laundering and drug trafficking. Tomas Cabal reports from Panama City.
According to legislator Alberto Alemán Boyd, Panama's National Assembly will conduct hearings to investigate money laundering in the Panamanian construction industry. Mr. Alemán said that his committee will look into the operation of the Colón Free Zone to determine if commercial activities by the more than 3,000 businesses located there are being used by Colombian drug lords to launder funds and to ship cocaine to the United States. Judges and prosecutors that have allowed drug dealers to post bail in violation of Panamanian law will also face stiff questioning by the legislative committee. For National Public Radio, this is Tomas Cabal in Panama City.
The government says housing starts fell 5.2% last month. It's the first decline in 4 months, and it's thought to be tied to rising mortgage interest rates. The news comes 2 days after the Federal Reserve boosted short-term interest rates for the 6th time this year. On Wall Street, stock prices closed lower today. The Dow lost more than 17 points to end at 3,828. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. A German court has convicted one of East Germany's top secret agents during the Cold War for treason. NPR's Deidre Berger reports.
The former NATO employee must serve a 12-year prison sentence for betraying NATO secrets to Stasi, the East German Secret Service, and the KGB. The court found German-born Rainer Rupp guilty of passing on a comprehensive array of classified information from NATO headquarters in Brussels to the Warsaw Pact from 1977 until the fall of the wall. During the trial, 49-year-old Rupp pleaded guilty to the charges. He said his motive was to work for world peace by helping the Warsaw Pact achieve military parity with NATO. His codename was Topaz, probably an allusion to the Soviet agent in a Leon Uris novel. His British-born wife received a 22-month suspended sentence for helping her husband.
I'm Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
An industry watchdog says Exxon and Union Carbide are among the worst companies for pollution. The Council on Economic Priorities lists eight businesses as the nation's worst corporate polluters. The eight are not ranked. Exxon is on the list for the second year in a row for the 1989 Valdez oil spill. Union Carbide is cited for a, quote, deplorable record of chemical spills. It also hasn't built the promised hospital for victims of the firm's 1984 gas leak in Bhopal, India. Others on the list include International Paper, Westinghouse Electric, Southern Company, Texaco, Westvaco, and Maxim. All eight firms defend their environmental record and reject the report. Exxon says the report is unsubstantiated, unfair, and inaccurate. The Republican Party is looking for the city to host its 1996 presidential convention. San Diego is reportedly leading the pack. New Orleans and San Antonio are also strong contenders. One city not in the running, New York. It's been dropped like a hot potato to punish Republican Mayor Rudolph Giuliani for supporting Democratic Governor Mario Cuomo. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Lindy Boggs came to Washington in 1941, the year her husband, Hale Boggs, was elected Democratic congressman from Louisiana. 21 years later, on a campaign trip through Alaska, Hale Boggs' plane disappeared, never to be found. Lindy Boggs ran for her late husband's seat and won. She remained in Congress through 1990. Politics has been the family business. Boggs' late daughter Barbara was the mayor of Princeton. Daughter Cokie Roberts is a well-known congressional correspondent and political commentator. Son Tommy is an influential lobbyist. Lindy Boggs has written a memoir about her 50 years in political life called Washington Through a Purple Veil. She told me what Louisiana politics were like when her husband started his political career.
When Hale entered politics, it was a couple of years before 1941, and he entered full force as the chairman of a group of young people called the People's League, and we had formed a league of young people because there was a great deal of difficulty in our state. Our governor had gone to jail, and the president of our state university had gone to jail, several other politicians and businessmen of fine repute had all gone to jail. And it was really more or less up to the young people to be able to throw the rascals out and try to right the wrongs. And that's what we did in collaboration with a great many other groups.
How did you see your role as a congressman's wife when you first got to Washington?
Well, when we first went to Washington, there was a very structured social society. The social agenda. You had to call upon the people who were senior to your husband. And when your husband was a freshman member of the House, that was a great number of people. And there were very strict rules. There were calling days. You called on the spouses of the Supreme Court on Monday, the House of Representatives on Tuesday, the Cabinet on Wednesday, the Senate on Thursday, the Diplomatic Corps on Friday. You made no calls on Saturday, and you may return calls made to you accompanied by your husband on Sundays. So we never made any calls on Sundays.
When did it stop being that way?
After it was suspended during World War II, of course. And following the war, it was followed somewhat. But the government became so constant and so large that it was really an impossible situation to have a strict protocol as had existed prior to the war.
How did you see your role in your husband's career when he was a congressman in terms of issues versus entertaining? How much did you want to be involved with issues, and how much did you want to, you know, throw dinners and set the social agenda?
Well, when you're from Louisiana, the only thing you can say about entertaining and having meals is, thank God I'm not the wife of the French ambassador, because everybody expects you to have marvelous meals. And so that I greatly, of course, enjoyed the entertaining. And learned through the years to be able to entertain more and more people at the insistence of Hale's gregarious attitudes. But I was very involved in the issues. We had come up together as young protesters, and were very involved. The book that I've written about Washington Through a Purple Veil is so titled because of Hale's insistence that I be involved in issues. As I said earlier, we were a generation that was really more or less an isolationist generation. And his committee was considering the Lend-Lease Act, which was actually the United States' first official act into the warlike stance. And he asked me to come down to listen to the testimony because he was being convinced that it was something that was absolutely necessary, that the United States had to assume its responsibility in the family of nations, and that we had no alternative. But he wanted me to understand it from the testimony of the people who were the experts, so that it was a partnership that had been formed when we were very young. We'd edited the college newspaper together. Of course, he was editor-in-chief. I was only the woman's editor. But that was the highest place that a woman could aspire to at the time. And I was very involved in the issues, always.
Lindy Boggs is my guest. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Lindy Boggs. Her new memoir about her 50 years in political life is called Washington Through a Purple Veil. When your children were young, how did you deal with all the work that you had to do and your responsibilities with raising the children?
Well, the children were invited into politics at the rate that they wished to participate. And sometimes they wished to participate fully, sometimes they didn't wish to participate in various activities. And we respected their desires. Mostly they enjoyed the fray. I tried to protect them from the unkind remarks and difficulties of that other people heaped upon their father, and thought that I was doing it very successfully, came home one day and found them sitting in front of the radio screaming back at it. They were listening to to it all along. But they came out of the experience all feeling an obligation to work in some regard in politics, and that makes me feel very comfortable about the way we reared them.
Did you have any role models in your life about how to divide time between work and mothering?
Well, I had many role models, but most specifically I had my grandmothers, my mother, and my aunts. And Hale's mother was a great role model as well. But I was reared in the country, and on plantations, and a plantation was a totally autonomous operation, and the person who was the mistress of the house had to really have everything in place within the household and its peripheral activities by a large noontime meal, and it was astonishing to see the type of a very good discipline and organizational skills that went in into that endeavor. And then, of course, they had to organize all of their own cultural activities. To see them organize this full day, and then when the time demanded it, to be head of a Red Cross drive, to prepare for all the people who were stranded in a flood, I've learned a great deal about being able to organize your day around family and around cultural activities and around the public demands that someone who had training and experience should exert.
My guest is Lindy Boggs. She's written a new memoir called Washington Through a Purple Veil, and it's about her life as the wife of Hale Boggs, a former congressman from Louisiana, and then her life as a congressperson herself. I want to jump ahead to 1972, when your husband was on a campaign swing through Alaska and his plane disappeared, and neither he nor the plane were ever found. Your whole family went to Alaska shortly after he was declared missing. What was it like for you to go there, and what were you able to do?
Well, we were invited to go, which was a tremendous relief. And
why was that a relief?
Because you could go to the scene and be there and feel that if there was any way that you could be helpful, that you were on the scene and able to do so. And in addition, it gave us the firsthand knowledge, gave our family the firsthand knowledge of the remarkable kind of search that was launched and pursued. And we would never have known the extent of it, nor would we have known the graciousness and interest with which it was conducted, unless we'd been on the scene and had the daily briefings and been with the people. The Air Force had charge of it from Elmendorf Air Force Base in Anchorage, and the Coast Guard had charge of it from Juneau. And we would have briefings a couple of times a day. We also would have the wonderful pilots who would come off of the flights and take my hands in theirs and say, "Don't you worry, we're going to find him for you." And it was, and we were there, of course, with the news briefings, and so that it was a tremendous consolation.
You've never really found out anything about what happened, right?
No, the only thing that can be assumed is that the plane went down and in the water somewhere. They did find a plane that had gone down in World War II that had never been found previously. It was an enormous search, and our nation used everything at its command in order to conduct it. And the maps of Alaska were redrawn from the photographs that were taken in the search.
Do you hold out any hope that someday you'll find out what happened, the plane will be found?
I'm not sure. There was a time when that would have been very consoling to me, but I've learned to live with the situation as it exists. And I suppose I like feeling that it was sudden, and it was not physically difficult, and that they just went on to a happier horizon.
Lindy Boggs is my guest. More in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Tom Jelton reports tonight on military activity near Bihać in Bosnia, where Serb forces continue their counteroffensive. Also, the new Republican chairman of the House Education and Labor Committee would outline his view of where the Republican Party wants to be leading the country on education. Some doctors in the U.S. are reported to be performing abortions by using drugs made for other purposes. Richard Harris reports that a researcher believes he has cloned dinosaur DNA for the first time. Other scientists are expressing caution. And Linda Wertheimer talks with Don Walser, not your ordinary Texas Cowboys singer. He's starting up full-time at age 60.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. My guest Lindy Boggs has written a political memoir about her life as a congressman's wife, then as a member of Congress, called Washington Through a Purple Veil.
How did you decide to run for your husband's seat?
I had been, pushed is probably a good word, by several friends and several different groups. So there were a couple of months in there where I had people asking me to run, and my stock answer was that we had a congressman, and when we found him, he was going to ask us what took us so long. There was a time of having to face the fact that he was truly gone when there had to be an election for the majority leader. And Tip O'Neill had been the majority whip, and he very graciously called me to find out if it would in any way upset my feelings if he entered the race for the majority leadership. And of course, I told him, oh, no, Tip, it wouldn't hurt my feelings at all, because you're the one person I know who'd give it up to him when he comes back. But that was the time I had to face the fact that we had to get on with another election.
When you decided to run for your husband's seat, did you still hold out any hope that he would be discovered? He would be found?
Yes, I did. I continued to hold out hope for a long time.
Was there a time when you knew that you'd stopped hoping?
Actually, I think that it was not that I'd given up hope, I suppose, but that I had come to perhaps a practical realization. I was a delegate to a World Bank International Monetary Fund meeting in Kenya, in Nairobi, and I had accompanied Hale on several trips of that sort and had been backup for him and helped him with his testimony and things so on. But here I was a delegate, and I had the responsibility for making decisions with the United States group. And I think that perhaps that was when the full realization came upon me.
That you had this burden on your shoulders.
That I was really, I wasn't a stand-in for Hale, mm-hmm. That I was the member myself.
When I interviewed Cokie, I asked her if she thought that you changed a lot when you became a member of Congress yourself, and she said something to the effect that you were always a very strong-centered person, and she didn't think you changed in any fundamental way, but she thought what was most difficult for you was was voting. Because when your husband voted, you would often have the job of smoothing things over. And then when you were voting yourself, who is going to do that? You had to take a stand. And I guess you didn't have the wife to smooth it over for you.
Well, Lady Bird called me and tried to persuade me to run. And when she thought she had, she said, "Darling, you think you can do it without a wife?" but Cokie and Barbara were both very, my daughter Barbara, were both very strong in their counseling of me in this regard. And they said, "Mine, you have to realize the hardest thing you're going to discover is that on the floor of the House, there's no maybe button. you have to push the button, yay or nay." And they were correct. That was the hardest part of my job.
During some of your time in Congress, your daughter, Koki, was covering Congress. Your son-in-law, Steve Roberts, was covering Congress for the New York Times, and then he wrote about Washington for U.S. News and World Report. Was it awkward for you to have two of your family members covering Congress?
No, because we had a very good relationship, professional relationship, and still kept our loving family relationship. Once someone asked Koki what she liked best about her job, she says, giggling with her mother in the speaker's lobby. But they didn't feature me, and I didn't give them any scoops.
You announced your retirement from Congress in July of 1990 because your daughter Barbara had cancer and you wanted to spend time with her. And she died just a few months later. So after you retired, you never really got the time with her that you wanted. Tell me about what it was like to retire and to retire at a time when you had suffered this terrible loss.
Well, actually, I made the decision to retire, hoping that I'd have more time to spend with Barbara, because it was an election year and I would have had to enter into the election contest, of course. And I simply decided that instead of doing that, I would spend the time with Barbara. Unfortunately, of course, she died before the end of that term. But it was the right time for me to retire. She gave me a gracious exit, and I have not regretted it one bit.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you. It's been a joy to be with you.
Lindy Boggs' new memoir is called Washington Through a Purple Veil. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Audrey Bentham, and Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Library of Congress has added 25 films to the National Film Registry. One of them is Taxi Driver. On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, we feature an interview with the film's screenwriter, Paul Schrader. And with two big books out about Marlon Brando, we hear from the director who discovered him, Ilya Kazan. Join us for the next Fresh Air.